Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, everyone, save your tears, but it's the last podcast of the series and we've all gathered together back in the studio to reflect on the final day of the Six Nations and also to look back on the tournament as a whole. It's the usual voices, except all a bit wearier after the last 7 weeks. You've got one Charlie Morgan.
Let's finish strong, Colsey.
Oh, pep talk. I didn't know I needed one, but I'm enjoying it. And one Charles Richardson as well.
Yeah, we'll go out on a high.
Oh, look at you two. You're brimming with positivity.
It's because it's the end. It's not the end, it's just the beginning.
You've also got myself, Ben Coles. Gents, where were you this weekend?
Double Leon. Enjoying.
I thought you were about to say Dublin then, and I was so like, have I woken up in an alternate reality? Double Leon, yes.
No, we managed to get to the right place. And we spent a lot of the weekend together, actually. It was lovely and got a good game at the end of it.
What did you do?
Well, on Saturday on game day, we had a lovely walk around and went up to the Basilique. We probably bumped into a lot of England fans, maybe lots of pod listeners, unwittingly. And then we went for some oysters.
I saw your photo.
Yeah, some pre-mashed oysters in the little food market in Lyon, which were absolutely gorgeous.
Nice little market. Didn't bump into the stag do. Saw the stag do's from afar. Heard the stag do's from afar. Bumped into almost quite literally Imanol Arunwodiki.
Oh, cool.
On our way to the ground as well, where we found another place to watch Wales Italy.
I mean, this all sounds very enjoyable. I've got to be honest. Did you do any work?
Wholesome would be the word.
Well, what you have to remember is it was a 9 p.m. local time kickoff, which was hellish, really. And also for those who weren't in Lyon, it's a gorgeous city. It really is. Getting to that stadium and back is an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, hated that during the World Cup for the Wales Australia game. So I can imagine to go to a France game that it must have been even worse. Yeah, it lets it down. Lets it all down.
You are forgetting that midway through the light show. At what is a wicked stadium, in fairness.
Yeah, I'll give you that. It is a good venue. I was in Dublin for the coronation of Ireland as back-to-back Six Nations champions, and it was fine. Everybody just sort of seemed to just shrug their shoulders and clap the end result and went about their day. I mean, they're getting spoiled, I think. How many titles is that? 5 in 11 years?
Was it edgy? It seemed we were watching without volume. In the press room, sort of underground press room in Lyon, and felt edgy.
I think until Ireland and Irish fans realised that Scotland weren't really going to score. As in, they were defending really well and they were keeping Ireland out. But actually, that they were struggling to get anything together in attack. And Finn Russell had his worst game of the tournament, I think. As soon as Porter scores that try, obviously everyone relaxes. But now I think everyone was kind of quietly confident because Scotland just couldn't really fire
even the last play.
Well, yeah, I think even then I didn't.
It was written.
I wasn't backing Scotland to score two tries in the final 3 minutes to win it.
We'll get into it, but it just always had the sort of from watching on TV, it always just looked like Scotland were clinging on for the whole game, basically. I mean, just trying to spoil the party.
Defended brilliantly, but I think if you've only scored 6 points by 70 minutes, then you need everything.
That's fair.
To win in Dublin, and actually, for once, their attack didn't really fire and their defence was brilliant, whereas for most of the tournament, it's been the other way around.
I am sensing a little bit of somebody who's done their match report and is going, that's the way it was, and I'm not doing a rerun.
Well, it was more I was writing about Scotland and I was just kind of like, I was willing them to do more. Because, I mean, what a weird tournament. We'll get into Scotland. A few, just to put you on the spot to start, let's start with a few little awards. Mm-hmm. If you're thinking about... What was your favourite game of the tournament? And Charles, don't hide. I'm looking right at you. What was your favourite game?
Well, it's quite selfish and it's quite personal, but I was there for France-Italy and I loved it. I thought it was great in Lille. I thought it had the most dramatic finish of the tournament, more than England-Ireland, just because there were so many variables and so many things that sort of, or so many stars aligned for the denouement of that game, with, you know, in a roofed stadium, the ball blowing off the tee, then the semi-charge down, total confusion, the ball hitting the post, then Yoram Mofana just blind panic charging the ball into touch. And obviously we had the Italy second half comeback and their sweeping length of the field try. I think that was the start of this superb Italian renaissance that we've seen in this tournament. And so, yeah, I'm going to pick that one, despite the fact there are two other outstanding candidates, both involving England, which I'm guessing you two might.
Spoilers.
Might.
You go first. Pick.
Can I pick two? One that I was there for, which was the last one. So France-England was a cracker, but Italy-Scotland was brilliant as well.
It was. Yeah, Italy-Scotland was and was high in consideration. I actually said England-Ireland in some Six Nations awards, which should be up on the website today, purely because of what it meant in terms of denying Ireland the slam. The finish is just nice and kind of storybook, isn't it? Yeah, and it sounded like Twickenham woke up for the first time in a few years. So that was what I went for, and a player of the tournament, if you had to pick one. Charlie,
can I nip him first and get Ben Earl, please?
Of course you can.
Really arrived. I know he had a fantastic World Cup, but I think, as he will know himself, he's hard on himself and he uses that to kind of spur himself. I think he would have thought that he hadn't particularly performed in the Six Nations prior to this, went well against Wales, and then it was, can you do it against Scotland, Scotland, Ireland and France. I thought Jack Dempsey actually outplayed him in the Scotland game, but then he was fantastic in the last two.
Well, Charlie's somewhat stolen my thunder there, because I probably would have gone Ben Earl as well. As it happens, I'll go for my second, which is probably a combination of the Italian centres, Tommaso Menoncello and Juan Ignacio Brexit. Oh no, he's had a rebrand to Nacho, hasn't it? Hasn't he?
What's that then? Men on Brex.
Men on Brex.
Brexcello.
Yeah. Menoncellex. Yeah. He's now Nacho Brex. I mean, he's
Nacho
had a rebrand.
Just sounds better.
Yeah, yeah. They've rebadged it, you fool. So I'd go for those two centres who were at the heart of everything good about Italy. That sort of midfield fluidity, and also Menoncello is just an absolute brute with the ball in his hand, isn't he? I mean, he's got thighs bigger than my entire body, I think, and just he's a proper handful to put down.
He's the major and the very, very sad omission from my team in the tournament.
He's not no.
Scandalous.
Not
scandalous, that is. Scandalous.
If Bundyaki's playing for anyone else apart from Ireland, you're going, who's this guy? This guy's ripped up the championship.
Yeah. You must click on that, listeners, to see who else is in the team in the tournament. Yeah,
and leave your comments.
And leave your comments. I'd leave your lovely comments
friendly
about
comments.
Charlie's team. I'd go Bundyaki. If anything, he's kicked on a bit since the World Cup, which I didn't expect. He's almost better running up to the game line and with those little passes out the back than I can remember. And I think he's been a lovely kind of comfort blanket for Jack Crowley in a way, just sort of having him there as an outlet and as an easy person to go to.
I don't want to go too far down and go too tangential, but is he pound for pound the strongest rugby player on the planet?
That's a good question.
In terms of like weight to strength ratio?
Yeah, no, it's a fair question, because he's not...
Ever going backwards or being now... I mean, Chesham hit him really hard sideways, which is a slightly different kettle of fish, but I just remember a couple of times in the Scotland game, he was almost standing start, like bouldering people. Just like it was just mad.
Sam Underhill chopped him a couple of times, but Aki was still winning the game line. I think one of them he got up and went again. And you're like, normally people stay hit when Sam Underhill gets involved. But yeah
he's a, and he boshed Martin.
That went under the. I saw that. Totally missed that at the game, but watched it back. And it's like somebody's just gone flying in his scrum cap. Oh, it's George Martin.
Yeah. England's best tackler has just been absolutely sat down by Bundyaki.
I know. I think he's on another level at the moment. And there's some sort of Lions tour coming up next year. We're not going to talk Lions 15s. But if he's not in it, first test, I would be very surprised. Just finally, before we dig into France-England, Charlie, you were on Reddit yesterday. Chatting to the world. What was the world saying?
I was doing an AMA, so it was an Ask Me Anything, and just had questions flying in on all sorts, from England under 20s to general players of the Six Nations, teams of the Six Nations, as we've just discussed, to there was one on doping, there was one on rugby journalism, a couple on articles that have gone live on our site. So yeah, I mean, you can look back at it, but I'm sure we'll be doing another one in due course.
Not doping in rugby journalism. Two separate topics.
Probably, yeah.
God,
no, there wasn't.
You're gonna blow it wide open, Charlie.
You did pause. I just a thought entered my head.
Were there any questions on breakfast?
It's quite funny.
No, sadly.
Oh.
No, save them for the next one.
Oh, that's a shame. Right then, let's chat more about Leon. Okay, I keep forgetting that England lost this game because I said to you a couple of times, I think, did I say to you yesterday, what a great win or something, or that's a great victory? Charles, it doesn't really feel like they lost.
Steve Borthwick doesn't believe that they lost either, famously, does he?
Why?
He said after the game that England did not lose, they just ran out of time, which is apparently a Michael Jordan line.
Oh, is it?
Works okay. Better when it's coming out of Michael Jordan's mouth, maybe, than... the England rugby head coach when they've lost to France. But I appreciate the optimism, and I do think he was touching on a more sort of valid point, which was that, you know, it came down to one final kick after England had given it a really good lash, and they had built on what they did against Ireland in terms of playing with much more attacking purpose and dynamism. And I think that, they did lose. It was gutting for England fans who were there. We were chatting to a few afterwards and they were like sort of absolutely gutted, but I think they were just very proud as well. It was conflicting emotions for them. I think they were very proud with the way that their team played. Not many teams win in France. England, certainly not many England teams win in France, and they came within a whisker really and played the better rugby, outscored. I mean, how many teams go to France and outscore them on tries?
I think it follows on quite nicely from the discussions we've been having here, where we've been saying, are England fans, after sort of the Italy result, which actually looks better in retrospect, but certainly the Wales win, 16-14 in a quite sort of edgy, dour one, are England fans, do they want to be losing 30? You know, we were using scores like the score that happened in Lyon. And I guess this is going to flow into, will England actually be disappointed when they reflect on the fact that they did get turned over, and I think they really will, because I think it was a France team with a lot of unfamiliar combinations, a lot of naivety about it, and I think England will reflect that they were quite loose in going down 16-3, quite ill-disciplined, and then they're still conceding a lot of tries in transition. Their transition defence just has to get better before New Zealand. That said, the progress that they've shown in attack is kind of so obvious that is kind of an overwhelming positive for a lot of people that have watched that game.
Let's break it down in chunks, because watching it back yesterday when I was coming back from Dublin, it did feel like three games in one, sort of. So that first 20 minutes, they actually do quite well to kind of contain France. The scrum holds up. Genge's height was great, wasn't it? And Antonio couldn't quite get the power that he wanted. It was a bit like England at the start of the tournament, where it was a lot of box kicking and a lot of control and a lot of territory, and the score was kept low, wasn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, and George Ford kicked that early penalty. England had a lead, and then it was just one lost line out. France scored a worldie, and then suddenly their tails are up, the crowd get behind them, they're all jumping, and they were very difficult to contain. But I think England will be disappointed, because they surely would have known that was coming. You know, you don't go to France without them having a purple patch. You know, they were always going to do that. They were always going to score a try or two. Let's be honest, England, even if they were the best defensive side in the world, France will score tries. But they leak tries too. But I think the most disappointing thing for England, and if you're being hypercritical, I mean, we said it live, was that they had that lead in the 70th minute, well, 70th minute plus, and they couldn't see it home, and they'd worked so hard with that Freeman try to get themselves back in front with a genuine, realistic shot of winning that game, having trailed by 13 points, and they couldn't quite see it out. And I don't know if that's a bench thing. I think probably the France bench brought slightly more. Maybe the English bench brought a more sort of, you know, to sort of defend the lead and contain it rather than the French bench, which brought a lot more dynamism. They deployed their bench really early, France. When England scored those two quick-fire tries after half-time, the whole front row was changed. Tau Fifanua came on for Mayafu, which felt like quite punchy changes. And, you know, they rolled the dice and it paid off.
Yeah, the Tau Fifanuas were really kind of pivotal, their introduction. I was just going to make the point that the two ultimately, out from this tournament, the two games that England have lost have been, they've lost, when they've lost possession and teams have scored straight away, Scotland, now France, that's been really damaging. And yeah, just to kind of reiterate, the All Blacks are pretty good at attacking in transition, so that's just got to get better very quickly.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, because you've written about England's attack, Charlie, and kind of broken down what was good. There's some interesting George Ford quotes knocking around afterwards where he talked about kind of post-Scotland, the mindset change to wanting to kind of be a team that does well with ball in hand, be a threat, ask questions, fire shots, be that attacking team, be on the front foot a lot more. The tries look great. Part of me wants to say fantastic England passing, and it is. It's part of it also just shocking French defence a couple of times, caused by the uncertainty that England created. So I'm thinking about Fiku for the first try, Thomas Ramos for one later on.
I think it's that the tries are an endorsement of the coaching that Richard Wigglesworth and Felix Jones are doing together. We keep hearing that they're dovetailing together. Felix Jones is renowned as this guy that is really good at figuring out weaknesses among opposition sides, and they went after Ramos relentlessly. What was quite good, I think, when you take the kind of tries, kind of if you look at them overarching, is there's loads of little things that are doing well. So the kick pressure is yielding points and try scoring opportunities. They're looking for opportunities, scanning for opportunities on the counter. The Leo Barré deliberate knock-on, which France really got away with, that's from kick pressure. They win back a box kick from Alex Mitchell. George Ford then finds space behind Biel Barré. It's a poor kick from Biel Barré, and Freeman, who's pressurised Biel Barré, is coming back, looking for opportunities, calls it out and makes that breakdown there. That's really good. That's pressure plus, right? That's the plus bit that maybe England were finding it difficult, but they're really connecting their game plan now, which is really impressive. Really good stuff off the back of lineouts on the gain line with Ollie Lawrence running like a 13 as he does for Bath, with Henry Slade quite good in that first receiver position. There's lots of really positive stuff, and I think that's kind of what the piece is hinting at, is that there's real room to progress on top of that now.
And Ford's been a lot flatter in the last couple of games.
Really so self-aware.
Lots more late kind of decisions with ball in hand, which has helped.
Which has been which we've always thought of as his strength. And it's really self-aware of him to say the Scotland game was a catalyst for me to... Well, I think it probably happened after the Wales game, and then in the Scotland game, they had those mistakes while being kind of positive with how they were trying to play. The cohesion was probably letting them down, and then that clicked over those 2 weeks that they had prior to Ireland, and then they carried that on. I think George Furbank's injury probably on the whole hurt them, but they still gave it a really good crack.
I agree. I think they win with Furbank. I think if Furbank stays on the field, I think they win that game. That's not to take anything away from Marcus Smith. But I just think it took him 5 or 10 minutes just to get back into the rhythm of playing fullback. And I think if Furbank stays, then they would have built and built and built. And just very quickly on Ford, this playing flatter thing, yeah, he's playing a lot flatter, but it's often not a conscious decision. It's not a sort of, I'm going to play flat, I'm going to play deep. That comes from how you're generating momentum and how you're sort of manipulating the gain line. And he's been allowed to play flatter because England have been more dominant in the carry. Their forwards have been more dominant. They've been getting front football. The personnel hasn't changed, but the running lines have changed. You've seen Ben Earl, who, you know, nominally an open side flanker, who is playing number eight, playing to his strengths. Now he's using even 2 meters away from defenders when he's carrying off slow ball. He's using his very, very quick feet and his agility to beat defenders, which he wasn't necessarily doing before. It was a case of just coming around the corner and just trying to, you know, batter down the door. Now, him, Chesham, and you've got Martin trying to batter down the door. You've got Genge, but also Genge has good feet. And all of a sudden, these England forwards who are quite strong, they're running at holes and they're not running at defenders. And that's what's getting them on the front foot, rather than just pure ballast. And once you're on the front foot, it's much easier for Ford to play flatter because the defence is on the back foot and you've got more time to play flatter. So that's how it's happening. It's an entire piece.
Alex Mitchell, very important. All of a sudden, a really, really important player for England, I think, because he facilitates exactly what Charles is talking about there.
I was just going to ask a bigger question about England, because obviously they've had this fairly transformational mindset switch post-Scotland, and I think everybody's certainly on board with it because it's been great to watch. Was there any way that they could have played like that from the start of the Six Nations, or was that always impossible given what they wanted to do with the defence? I kind of feel that they had to break it up in chunks. I mean, we were sort of saying that the attack was on the back burner, weren't we, because they were trying to fix the defence. I don't know if they could have played like this in attack from the start. What do you two think?
They'll reflect on how they used their time, but they absolutely had to win those first two games to give themselves a chance, didn't they? And I think that was probably the best chance of doing that, because I mean, they were in a tricky spot against Italy. One of my favourite moments of the tournament was Tommy Allen's try in that game, and the atmosphere was because of the possibility of Italy turning over England for the very first time, and they were a dangerous kind of, and a spoiler alert, I've chosen George Ford is my fly half of the tournament, because I think even in those first two games, England will reflect on him as a kind of steadying influence and using his experience to get England out of tough spots against, they were down, was it 10-0 at least against Wales as well?
Cyrene McGeachan in his column wrote that he thought that those 2 weeks that incorporated Yorkshire and York, no Yorkshire bias, of course, as he joked at.
It was Yorkshire what, wasn't it?
Yeah. Were pivotal for England. Just having that sort of 2 week block after Scotland to reset and build ahead of Ireland were pivotal. And also, we were having this conversation yesterday. Do England beat Ireland if they win at Murrayfield? I think probably the jury's out on that one. I don't think they do.
Can I test another sliding doors theory?
Sure. Love it.
We know that the television man of matches can be quite arbitrary, and it's usually sometimes one person's opinion. If Freddie Stewart is man of the match against Wales, which he had a big shout for being, does he lose his place to George Fairbank?
I will say yes.
Probably, yeah.
I think so. I think the way the wind was going in terms of what they wanted to do with Fairbank, the way Fairbank changed how they play, I'd say probably.
I think so, but I just think it's interesting.
It's an interesting
in the context of the Six Nations. We've written so many more eyes are on what's going on, and the narratives get kind of forged off the back of that, and then they can be quite heavy. So that it takes quite a lot for it would take more, I think, for Steve Borthwick to kind of make a call if there was that weight of opinion sort of on Stewart's side, I guess.
And what do we think of final tackle?
Well, I was just going to ask you that. Yeah. So the final penalty.
Well, you've seen it on TV. So
I've seen it on TV. I'll be honest. I had to because the call comes in from the TMO about two phases later. Initially, I thought it was for a tackle by Ethan Roots, which looked a bit fine, and I was like, that can't be what it's for. And you have to go back to see this Ben Earl no arms tackle where he's very low. I've seen a lot of people talking about consistency with these no arms tackles. I don't know how much of a crutch that is, only because Ellis Genge got penalised for the same thing earlier in the game for a no-arms tackle. So it wasn't like England hadn't been warned about them. In that moment, because it's the final minute, because the game is on the line, I just feel like the officials are so twitchy to make sure that they don't miss anything. And so, and Gardner obviously let it play, but for the TMO to come in and call it, I think it probably, by the letter of the law, it's a penalty.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. Should the TMO be coming in the 79th minute for a 50-50? Really, yeah. It's 50-50, I think. No, I think it's one of those 50-50s where it could go either way, and I don't think either team can complain.
Yeah.
I don't think France would have complained had it not been given, and I think I don't think England can complain that it was. Should the TMO be coming in? We use the phrase clear and obvious all the time. Is that a clear and obvious error from Angus Gardner to miss that no-arms tackle from Bernal? I don't think it is, and I don't think a test match of that magnitude, of that standard, and of that drama should have been decided. I mean, this is nothing. This is no English sour grapes whatsoever, because a betting man would have put money on France winning anyway, continuing and getting another penalty that Ramos kicks. But for that match to be decided on that, it does sort of leave a bit of a bitter taste in the mouth, in all honesty.
So I initially thought the touch judge had called it, but just from the position on the field, and then it became apparent that the TMO had called it in. I think I can understand English grievances about it, for sure, given the timing. Charlie, what do you think?
I think it'd be really interesting to see how Ben Earl reacts, because I think, you know, as we've...
Well, he was convinced it wasn't him.
Yeah.
Chatting to Gardner on the field after it was given, he was like, it can't be me.
But he players talk about painting pictures, don't they? He paints that picture quite a lot. Even if you go back to George Martin's hit on Franco Mostert at the World Cup, Ben Earl is kind of upending him in a quite a similar way. He did it a few times during the game where you're going, it's almost like how, not quite as obvious, but almost like how Luke Houndicky tackles. But, and we know that Ben Earl is voracious in his appetite to get better, and he goes down wormholes to look at things and make sure that he's getting better all the time. And I just wonder what he thinks about this and how he reacts. Would be really interesting.
Was it on Roman Taufifanua? Am I remembering that correct? It almost seems that Taufifanua, the lock Taufifanua, is so big that he knocks Ben Earl's arm out the way almost, and makes it look like just the sheer force coming through almost tucks Ben Earl's arm in after the contact, which makes it look bad. I'll just repeat what I've said. I don't think they can complain that it was given as a penalty, because it does look like one, but it is marginal. It is 50-50. And should the TMA be coming in to decide the game on that? Probably not.
There's a wider point about the sheer complexity of tackle laws in general, because the Six Nations account put out a clip of Bundiaki making a great tackle on, I think it was Carl Steyn, and saying like, oh, that's perfect tackle technique. But if you pause it at the right point, like Bundiaki's knee is on the floor, and technically you're not allowed to tackle while your knee's on the floor.
Can we talk about, speaking of tackle technique, Peno on Lawrence?
You were convinced, weren't you? You were convinced.
It looked so weird. It looked like Peno had just stopped and almost let Lawrence run into him with both of them upright, which World Rugby have sort of been on this crusade to stop collisions like this happening. Everybody cheered. Peno stood over him almost like, yeah, have some of that. But it's like, well, that's pretty illegal.
What's have and some of that in French?
Oh, God, I'll rest. Can you stop asking me these really difficult translator questions on the spot?
But it was kind of like brushed under the carpet, let's play on. And which is good in a way, and what we've wanted. We don't want TMOs coming in, but come in for that and not the one at the end.
Not the one at the end.
Yeah.
And what do we make of France and the tournament? Only one defeat in the end, but what a bizarre kind of few weeks they've had. Charles, what do you think?
Yeah, it got better for them, didn't it? Blooded a lot of new talent, some of which really shone. Nolan Le Garec and Leo Barry certainly at the end. I think there's still question marks over Deporte. I know he's very young, but I think they were very leaky in the midfield against England, and England exploited that really well. And, you know, it led Sean Edwards to say that it was France's worst defensive performance in his tenure was against England, which is tough to argue with, to be honest. I think they need to find a third fly half, because Thomas Ramos is not just not a test fly half. I think he's got away with it at club level, especially in a really dominant Toulouse side. But I think this summer the tour to Argentina is probably the time to either give Astoy go if Ntamack and Jalibert are both injured, or have a look at someone like Antoine Gilbert at Racing or Hugo Reus at La Rochelle. They've got some really, really brutish forwards coming through, Georges-Henri Colombe and Emmanuel Meafu, and Roman Taufifanua was excellent off the bench, as we've already mentioned. They're always going to be good, aren't they? Their under-20s are excellent. We haven't spoken yet about England's fantastic win there in the under-20s, but their under-20s generally are excellent. They've got Pasolo Tuolangi coming through, who's only 19 years old, who dropped down to play in the 20s. So their depth is scary. They're going to be fine. Are they as good as they should be? I mean, they finished second in the Six Nations, and that's probably not a terrible result for them. But are they playing as well as they should? Maybe not, but I think they certainly they showed glimpses of their potential against England, certainly. It was just a shame for England that France saved it to the best till last.
Right, let's chat about some of the other games this weekend, starting in Dublin.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends.
For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, what would you like to know about Ireland, Scotland? I know you're both itching to ask me questions.
What was the atmosphere like? Was it nervy?
It's kind of nervy to a point, but I think in the end, the celebrations at the end felt a bit kind of flat. And that's only because I think Ireland have just got very used to success now. What, 5 titles in 11 years? I mean, I find that hilarious. I remember when Ireland were a bit of a disaster, particularly in the early days of professionalism, and I was... As a younger lad, I was at the Grand Slam game in 09 where they beat Wales, and it was the end of a multi-decades wait to win, you know, a slam again, and that was viewed as this kind of huge seminal moment. And now look at them, they just bash out titles kind of every other year.
How far below their best were they, would you say?
Well, I mean, it talks about how France only went on an upward curve after the Marseille at the start. I mean, Ireland gradually got worse and worse as the tournament went on, but they started at such a ridiculous high with the way they kind of battered France away from home that I suppose maybe that isn't a surprise, really. I think what I found really interesting was Andy Farrell talking about the England game afterwards, and he mentioned how for the younger lads in the squad, who basically are kind of not through any fault of their own, just subconsciously got used to winning so many tests in a row, that England game is going to be, I think he said, it's going to be a powerful lesson for us moving forward. So actually quite a scary thought that it's not a terrible time to lose games like that first year of a cycle. And I know we talk about cycles a lot, but actually if you're going to have hiccups and you're going to, if areas are going to come up that are flagged and you need to address them, probably a good thing, and they'll be better for it, I think.
I think it's reasonably reassuring how difficult it is to win a Six Nations. I mean, we were kind of all worried, weren't we,
how hard it is to win back-to-back slams,
yeah,
as well.
How easy, potentially, it was going to be, or looking like it was going to be for Ireland. And also, I think, and it's maybe unfair to sort of single out these two players, but two players, so it kind of warned us maybe in the future against making these hot takes after three rounds when there's so much rugby left to play. And I'm just going to use the two players. So Cameron Winnett and Joe McCarthy emerged amazingly well in these first three games. And I think there's just a sign that to maintain, you've almost got to have a few seasons playing Six Nations, or maybe a few more seasons at senior rugby, to really maintain that form over the course of the whole championship. And not to single out Joe McCarthy, because we raved about him in France, he was phenomenal, but maybe found it hard to kind of keep up that level. He was still, I think, he's quite quiet at Twickenham, maybe quite quiet again against Scotland potentially. He's an awesome player with a massive future, but I think this will be a lesson that how difficult it is and how much stamina you've got to have to keep going over the course of a whole championship.
Yeah, I think they'll be pleased that they've had to problem solve a bit against Wales and against Scotland and had to kind of grind out wins and find ways to get around good defensive systems, really. I mean, Scotland, what a weird championship Scotland have had, and I've watched them 4 times out of 5. The only time I haven't watched them was the win over England, where they actually, you know, probably their best performance. They are an infuriating side to watch, because the talent is so clearly there, and they defended superbly in Dublin, like more like 240 tackles ish, like more than double what Ireland did. Loads of players tackling in the 20s, but they just couldn't get the attacking structure in place this time to kind of unlock defences until that late Hugh Jones try. I thought Finn Russell was a bit off his game. There was one scrum where Scotland tried to launch a strike move with Russell looping, and Gibson Park, who I think we all rate exceptionally highly, just scurried across and tackled him from the blind side and forced the knock on, and that kind of felt like a quite a big moment because Scotland just couldn't get those intricate kind of plays rolling as well as they have.
And Scotland, would you say quite fortunate for fourth? Given Italy two wins and a draw, Scotland just two wins. Have they got out of jail a bit there? I think they might have done.
Yeah, I think losing in Dublin and losing that way in Dublin isn't terrible because I don't think many people expected them to win in Dublin. I think Rome's the one that's killing them. France, look, circumstances at the end, should have won the game beforehand. You lose to a freak decision. Okay.
So swings and roundabouts are in it because they could have lost to Wales first up easily.
Yeah,
lost that game
exactly.
In Cardiff.
But I think Rome's the one where that was the one Townsend said after, where they actually did dip below their level, where the penalties and the mistakes in the second half were kind of unacceptable. And I think that's the one that will bug them the most, because if they win that, it's three from five and you've lost two tight games otherwise to Ireland and to France. It's not as bad.
What was Townsend's demeanour like afterwards?
Well, I asked him how much of a missed chance he felt this was, and he kind of sighed and he was like, yeah, like, you know. But it's a tricky one. We keep asking me about the France game, and I feel like we shouldn't keep talking about the France decision because that isn't the be-all and end-all of their championship. But it does seem to keep coming up as this missed chance. I also think they need to look a lot more at themselves. I think they've missed, even though Stafford McDowell was quite good at 12 in Dublin, I think they missed Tuipulotu after his injury. I think he's such a key focal point of their attack, much like Bundiaki for Ireland. I think the amount of stuff that kind of goes through him in terms of getting gain line momentum, I think he was missed. They've got a bizarre summer schedule, Scotland.
Well, I'm wondering, it's come under some criticism, actually, and I'm going to go into bat for it a little bit. I think on the back of what you've just said there is that their starting 15 is very good, Scotland's.
Yeah.
And can trouble most teams in the world. But beneath that, they do struggle.
That's
you know,
the key, yeah.
They haven't got the depth. And actually, this summer tour, and that was proven against Ireland, where you know the benches were a factor, as they always are, when the game progresses in beyond the 60th minute. I think that tour this summer, they have to use it as a development opportunity to build a second sort of a second string 15 that is able to play in the same way as the first 15 in the same system and slip in seamlessly to get greater depth so that they can compete. The reason why Scotland are fourth is because of their depth. Realistically, their starting team, as they showed against England, where they have their first choice team, as near to the first choice team as they can get, they can really cause teams problems. I know England had an off day, but they can really cause teams problems.
Time to blood more players. Just to wrap up on this game, Peter Omani, it sounds as though that's his last game in an Ireland shirt, the kind of way he was talking about, and he's going away and have a chat with the family, and then also saying, if that is my last game, it's not a bad way to kind of hang up the jersey. Like it seems, for all intents and purposes, that probably is his final game in an Ireland shirt. We heard from Ryan Baird afterwards, just chatting about Omani's kind of influence on him, and here's what he had to say.
I told him twice today when we were before he went out, and after that, I look up to him so much. The way he can be so fun and part of the lads when he's off the pitch, but then the dedication he has to the way he plays rugby, the way he leads us, it's an absolute privilege to play with him and to be in the same position as well. You know, I pinch myself when I get to sit down and talk with him. He's just such an incredible player, but more importantly, a person. And I love, his beautiful family as well. And yeah, I cherish playing with him.
I think that shows just the kind of influence that Omani's had on this side. He's almost been a kind of perfect placeholder captain in a way, post World Cup, kind of just as a bridge, hasn't he? Given that he's won them another title.
Almost perfect. I think he was quite underwhelming against England, and I think in the when he was made captain, that was quite a big decision, wasn't it? Because Ryan Baird was pushing very hard. He's a serious athlete, and he'd been looking good for Leinster. Put on a bit of Terry, I think, hasn't he?
He's a big lad.
Yeah. So he was clearly kind of looking to steel himself for Test rugby. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that transition now with the first kind of test of it, a series in South Africa, which isn't going to be easy for those back five forwards. But yeah, also just a player that will be, Peter Omani will be remembered for huge moments. You know, Jackal turnovers with his team on the ropes, big line out steals in his own 22, that sort of thing. Yeah, fantastic player.
And talking about Scotland building depth, that South Africa tour is going to be interesting for Ireland's depth, and because they kind of need, they could do with another option at fullback. Jordan Lama kind of was rushed in for this when Keenan dropped out, and he hadn't started a test for years, really. They've sort of done that with Calvin Nash coming in on the wing and Kieran Frawley at fullback as well. Like there's a few players who've slotted in. I think South Africa as well, they could just do it to maybe adding a couple more forwards into the mix, just to kind of maybe give Craig Casey a bit more of a run at scrum half as well behind Gibson Park, just to, you know, build that depth.
Definitely. You wrote, I think, after the World Cup, Charles, their age profile is potentially concerning. So that process is going to have to...
It is. I think David Walsh noted in the Sunday Times, lots of toddlers on the pitch at the end, which tells you how many of the squad are kind of like in their 30s or like over 30. It's true. Yeah, they are. They are getting older. Let's head to Cardiff. Oh boy, Wales. Right. Wales with the wooden spoon for the first time since...
2003.
God, yeah. It's... And I think we can safely say they saved the worst till last, because don't let the scoreline fool you. They were comprehensively outclassed by Italy and actually should have been way, way further behind at half time. Wales had no... They lacked physical intensity. They lacked precision in attack. The defence was patchy. The set piece continued to struggle against Italy's scrum, which actually in the last couple of weeks against Scotland Wales has looked pretty decent. Charlie, I mean, I don't know. Where do you go from here? You've got Warren Gatland kind of saying that he offered to resign post-match. It's desperate.
It is, and that first half was absolutely horrible, wasn't it? You're absolutely right. Italy should have been further ahead. They will get Jack Morgan back fit, which is a big fillip for them. In the power stakes, he's an exceptional player, and then they'll have that question over how they get him and Rafael in the same back row, because Rafael's been a standout player. I actually thought that during the World Cup, they punched above their weight. I don't know. They went pretty well in the World Cup, got out of a tricky group, were exceptional against Australia, and I actually thought some of their attacking incision was really good, which was kind of more why it was more disappointing that they didn't capitalise on opportunities that they had to beat Argentina and get through to, you know, an unlikely semi-final. They've got to find some of that again, and what's maybe slightly worrying is that teams that when you don't have that depth of players and you don't necessarily have that, you're maybe slightly behind in the quality stakes, that the onus falls on the coaching and the clarity of that coaching. And that's where there was that real gulf with Italy, I thought, because Italy looked like a cohesive side, even bringing in new players this championship, like Ross Vincent and Louis Leiner. Those players have slotted in and gone really well.
Friends of the pod?
Both friends of the pod. Both friends of the pod. And that is potentially the biggest worry for Wales, because is that coaching there bringing the players that they've got up to a level where they can be competitive? It has to be a question mark.
And here's more cycles chat. Is this just what they have to go through, Charles, with a group of young players, do you think, to be in a better position in 4 years' time, given the previous age profile of the squad, or actually are more alarm bells ringing?
That's certainly the positive interpretation, isn't it? That's the positive side of the coin, is that short-term pain, long-term gain, and this was a necessary reset to ensure that they can build something. And all the messages coming out of the Welsh camp from Warren Gatland, and also from George North, who obviously retired this weekend, retired from international rugby after the loss to Italy, was that, you know, this is a really talented young crop of players, and keep the faith, basically, to the Welsh public.
And just on North, just absolutely desperate way for a brilliant Wales career to kind of come to an end.
What was that injury?
I think, well, I thought it was knee, but he was in a boot afterwards. And sort of, I think, yeah, for him to, the result, firstly, but also the injury, I really felt for him, because he's just been phenomenal for Wales for so long. Now we get to talk positively about Italy. This is fun. They've been the best thing about this year's Six Nations, I'm going to say, in terms of this kind of mini resurgence and what we're seeing from them. The Lorenzo Pani trial is absolutely outrageous in terms of precise strike play move off a line out is absolutely delightful. Talk to me about what you love about Italy, you two.
Oh, what I love about Italy is that Gonzalo Quesada delivered on what we said he would potentially bring, which was kind of solidifying and making what Kieran Crowley incited as far as attacking ambition, attacking fluidity. He's just made that a little bit more robust, I think. And I think that's really exciting for their future. Michele Lamaro, friend of the pod, last year told us that he, which we've made this point again recently, but he said, look, we're learning on the job because a lot of us are really young, but we are going to learn together and we are going to get stronger because of that. And I think that's coming to fruition, which is just really exciting for how they're coming through, because, you know, their under-20s are doing really interesting things and have done for a while. I'm going to butcher his name, and I've forgotten his name. I was going to butcher it anyway, but they've got a wing who, in the 20s, who was phenomenal against Ireland. It was like he was like watching a computer game. I'll find his name when someone else is talking, but they really really exciting. And that, and as I said earlier, just highlighting the kind of value of that coaching clarity, because they know what they are as a side, and they're doing really really good things with that.
Best attack in the tournament, do we think? Best attacking team in the tournament this
I mean, I love Ireland's kind of phase play when it's fully motoring, but I think
in terms of consistency, if you think back to how they attacked against England in the opening round, which was mightily impressive.
Yeah, they've got no problem getting on the outside of a defence, have they? Because either a rush defence like England's or a kind of more drifty defence like Wales, like that, they can easily, they've both got the skills and the pace to get on the outside, like we saw for Banny's try.
And depth has long been an issue for them, but it seems like they're building a lot more now. Obviously, they've come and poached Lewis Leiner straight out of the grasp of England and Australia. Well, it was a three-way tie for him, wasn't it? Three-way split. At nine, you know, Pajarello and Varney. Varney seems to be playing some of the best rugby that he's played in an Italy shirt. Ross Vincent, who's one of the stars of the game against France and the win against Scotland, can't even get in the team.
I think the thing that should please people the most about Italy is that for years it was always about one player. It was always about Dominguez, and then it was always about Parise. And then 2 years ago, Capoverso did what he did in Cardiff to create that winning try, and everybody's kind of looked at him and thought, okay, we've got like one great Italian player to kind of, you know, hang our hat on, and he will be the one who takes them forward. Now it's team wide. Like when we were discussing team of the tournament nominations, how many Italians were coming up in different positions with different strengths? Like, it was fantastic. I think that's got to be the most pleasing thing, not just for Italian fans, but actually just fans of the Six Nations. Like, finally, Italy feel like a team of talented people, of talented players, and not just like one or two individuals.
Yeah, I mean, I know you picked George Ford in the end for your team of the tournament at fly half, but maybe it wasn't a vintage year for tens in terms of what we've seen and experienced, and we've been sort of spoiled over the last 10 years, haven't we, with sort of Sexton, Bigger, Russell, Farrell and Antamak and Jalibert. But I mean, Garbisi must have pushed him pretty close, I think.
Yeah, no, he's great. I actually, that was one of the positions where I totally copped out and pretty much named everybody. But that's what you meant to do, isn't it? You give on, just sprinkle honourable mentions around everywhere.
Even
to
Sam Costello.
He probably had a tougher tournament, didn't he? But it would have been pretty difficult to look good in that Wales side, yeah. I would say, because you don't have the solidity of combinations around you, and dare I say, you don't really have the clarity on how you're playing. He was getting roasted for kicking too much, and then I'm sure it wasn't looking very good either when they tried to put the ball through the hands against Italy from deeper. So he certainly had the trickiest brief. I still think he's a promising player.
I can't believe Menoncello didn't get in your team at the tournament.
I know. Charles was lobbying me on Sunday to put him on the right wing.
One game on the wing.
Which would have been, but I just tried to, you know, there's integrity to think about.
Very, very, very finally on Wales-Italy, just on the Warren Gatland saying that he offered to resign. I don't think any of us think he's actually going anywhere, do we? No.
I think that's quite an odd episode, though. Either way, isn't it? Because
what, to say it,
to say it out loud, and I don't know, to sort of, it looked like he was presenting that as a really kind of unusual situation that would never happen, and it's like, you have just had a quite bad Six Nations.
Can't see him going anywhere, Charles.
Not in the, not after what he said on. It would be a real about turn, real rug from the beneath everybody's feet if he were to resign or were to be let go. Now, I mean, I don't think the WRU can afford to let him go. And with that squad of players, who realistically would do better with in terms of the experience profile and the age profile? And do we think the cap rule needs to be relaxed? I mean, we've seen a lot of that written on social media about them relaxing the cap rule. But we had this conversation on Saturday. Who would that actually bring back in? Joe Hawkins at Exeter.
Which do you like less, the discussions about the cap rule or the roof in Cardiff? I mean, it's a hard debate. I would say
I like discussions about the roof more, unbelievably, because at least they're over quickly.
Just a big fan of weather.
Well, no, it's just they're over quickly, aren't they? We get to the game, roof's open or closed, then no one talks about it again. But this has been rumbling on for a while.
No,
it's used as a sort of a bit of a straw man, really. I'm not sure how much of a difference it would make. You know, people are saying that we need to be able to pick over 25 cap players. Fewer than 25 cap players who are playing outside of Wales. Well, who are those players? Who's been left out on that basis? Joe Hawkins at Exeter. That's about it, isn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of who's actually going to be disturbing the starting 15.
Yeah. Tough times for Wales. Brilliant times for Italy. That's the games. Let's dive into some questions. Okay, thank you for sending these either on social media, on X. Oh, I can't believe I said X. On Twitter, and also over Reddit as well, to Charlie when he did his AMA the other day. Just going to start with one from James, who asks, which England players not involved in this Six Nations would you like to see on the summer tour to Japan and New Zealand? Some of the successful under 20 squad, congratulations to them on their title win and that great win in France at the end. Anyone in particular who's kind of on your radar? I'd say Alfie Barbary would be one,
yeah,
for me.
100%.
Just kind of top of the list.
Dependent on him getting through the rest of the season injury free, I'd like to see Rafi Quirk thrown in there as just somebody that could dovetail quite nicely with Alex Mitchell, not forgetting that Jack Van Poortvliet's got to come back in as well. On the second part of James' question, I think it probably is too early for that under 20s crop. Although Junior Kapoku's,
I was going to mention Asher Opoku for Jaw as well.
I would take a prop or two.
Yeah, maybe. because you know that though you've got Joe Marler, Dan Cole, who are in the having an Indian summer at the minute, but they are not going to be. We don't know how long they're going to be around for. They're not going to be around forever. Hopefully they're around for as long as they can be, because they're playing fantastic rugby and they're certainly doing a job for England at the minute. But there needs to be props coming through. Ollie Slightholme is another name I'll chuck in. I think I'd really like to see him in and around that England squad. I think he's something really special, and I think he could Freeman-esque sort of winger. But also with this emergence of Emmanuel Fayiwoboso, that's such a tough back three to get into now for England. I mean, and Furbank and, you know, Freddie Stewart, a world class 15, not even in the squad for the past two games. So
Josh Hodge won't be long, I don't think. No. I think it might, maybe summer tour too soon, but it just kind of jogged my brain a bit when I was listening to, can't remember who it was now, but they were talking about how Fayiwoboso's transition had been easier because he was used to the blitz defence in Exeter, and I think obviously Josh Hodge has that on his side and is also super pacey, would be very dangerous in transition.
Guy Pepper was a late call-up to prepare for the France game. Everything I've seen from him at Newcastle Falcons this season suggests that he's certainly one to keep an eye on, and he went well for the A team against Portugal, although everybody did because they annihilated them. They'd be my three, certainly Barbary, Pepper and Slightholme.
They seem in a good position actually when you put it all that way. Question from Tighthead Locke, well, more of a take. He says Marcus Smith at 15 is the new Farrell at 12. It's not his best position, but he is the best in the country at that position. I feel like we would veer...
Certainly not his best position. Half right.
I feel like we'd veer away from that and say that it's Furbanks for now to lose 15.
What I would say is there is... there's a semblance of good take in that, because it's reasonably similar to the Farrell at 12 situation in what it allows the selection to look like. But I think that more comes into play from how the bench will look like. So if you've got Smith covering 10 and 15 from the bench, you can make sure you've got that direct centre in the 23 shirt, as Tui Lagi was on Saturday, and potentially someone like Max Ajomo might be in the future.
Yeah. Question from Harry: which team do you think has learnt the most about themselves in this Six Nations? I think Ireland will have learnt a lot about just kind of adversity, how to get around tricky defences, like we said. England have learned how to attack. So
I'm actually going to say Wales. I think
learned how bad things are,
and the scale of the problem, and the scale of the task, and the scale of the challenge. I think Scotland will
learn
be
the
most muddled. Yeah, definitely learn the least, and the most muddled, and the most sort of anxious. I think because
we did it again.
Yeah, two wins,
and Italy have learned that they can do it.
Yeah,
and hopefully that will kind of help them move forward. And one from Matt: does either Gatland or Townsend make it to the next World Cup? Well, that's an interesting question.
Either suggests he thinks both are off ski.
They're mutually interdependent.
If I reframe it slightly, which of them would you least expect to be at the next Rugby World Cup out of the two? As in, if one of them was more likely to not be there, part of me thinks Townsend.
Yeah.
Just because it's...
I'd agree with that.
7 years in charge. I feel like he's got a contract until 2026 as well, which is interesting timing from the Scottish Rugby Union. I think that was Mark Dodson's last hurrah, the former chief exec. I guess maybe Townsend. There's every chance. I mean, if Townsend gets the next World Cup, then he's been in charge for a decade. Like, that's
hell of an effort.
It's kind of unheard.
That's laughing.
It's kind of
unheard.
Maybe without a trophy.
It's kind of unheard of, isn't it? I mean,
except for the Calcutta Cup.
Just laughing at the CEO having a last hurrah, throwing in a
easy contract,
throwing in a little banter clause.
Yeah.
What, like Bernard Laporte did with Gautier?
Yeah, that's true.
I think that's fair as well. It's just such a long time, but I do think, and that's probably why the Six Nations was so disappointing, because they, throughout the build up to the World Cup, Townsend was saying, look, whatever we do at this World Cup, it's going to continue into the next cycle, and just to have such a tough time or tough series of results is more accurate, and the first kind of go of a new world cycle would be really disappointing.
Yeah, Charles, you haven't answered the question.
Oh no, I said I agree with you. I think Townsend.
Did you? Oh, yep. Sorry. Yep. I'm just not used to you agreeing with me. Sorry.
No,
sorry,
I think Townsend is the more likely. Obviously, it's difficult to predict the future, Matt, but I think Townsend is definitely the more likely of the two to not be at that tournament. But, I mean, betting wise, would you say they're both going to be there?
Well, I guess I'm wondering if the Wales thing continues, if it is a complete disaster, completely off the tracks, which I don't think it's going to be, just because I think they needed almost a rough year to blood players with a view for the future. So I can see Gatland being there. It's just the length that Townsend has been there, I think, which is interesting, because not many coaches stay for a decade. So that's the only thing that's on my brain. One from Charlie's Reddit AMA was: given the Six Nations usually gets in a million people for just 15 games and gets many more throughout Europe and the rest of the world, are the players getting their fair share in terms of cash? I think he's saying a player's basically getting paid enough for the amount of exposure that the Six Nations has. Well, England players get a fairly tidy
test fee,
don't they? Is that the last, I think we heard, that was around... It dipped a bit during COVID, but is it back around about 25k?
Yeah, still in around that.
I think there's a lot of strands to this, isn't there? I think, obviously, yes, there's a lot of money coming in, but the unions need to use that in a way to engage more fans, which they haven't been doing well, and to develop the grassroots more, to encourage more people to play rugby, to go out and pick up a rugby ball, and to make sure that we have that sort of, in all the nations, that talent factory coming through, so that the Six Nations remains a valuable product for years to come. You know, that is where the cash should be going. We've spoken a lot about how rugby is very, very poor at attracting or certainly filling the space, the online space, for Gen Z. And I think the players, everybody always wants to be paid more, don't they? But I think in terms of, if you're talking fair, I can't imagine there'll be too many qualms among the playing group for how much they're being paid. And I don't think they would say, oh, the Six Nations is a bigger tournament, so we deserve more we deserve more money for playing in it, because at the end of the day, Twickenham only holds 80-odd thousand people, and if it's full, it's full. It's the same if they play Australia in the autumn. If they play Ireland at Twickenham, it holds the same amount of people. The revenue is going to be pretty similar. And so I don't think the Six Nations means that the players should get paid more. No, I think they're pretty well looked after, certainly from an England perspective.
Okay, just to finish, a very quick summer preview. So Ireland are in South Africa, England are in Japan and New Zealand, Wales are in Australia, and Scotland, as we've discussed already, are going on a very, very jolly tour of Canada, USA, Chile and Uruguay. I think an interesting question might be, who's most likely to come back having won a series? I appreciate it's a bit tricky with England because it's only two tests in New Zealand. But if you're guessing now how England get on in New Zealand against the new All Black side under Scott Robertson, I think 1-1 would be great.
One win would be
amazing.
And I think they can.
I don't think it's impossible. Yeah.
I think there's a lot of unknown about how New Zealand are going to shape up as well, which is interesting, with injuries, with guys who are unavailable because they're playing in Japan, with how Scott Robertson adapts to Test rugby, because he's going to have to adapt to Test rugby. He might hit the ground running. That Ireland South Africa series is going to be great, because South Africa have been watching the Six Nations and will be very, very fired up to consolidate what they did in the World Cup. It's going to be awesome.
What do you reckon, Ireland South Africa? I'd lean 2-1 Springboks. I could see Ireland poaching one.
Two tests.
It's only two tests. Mm-hmm. I'd say 1-1. I could see 1-1.
Yeah, again. I could see 1-1. I can see 1-1. I can see 1-1 in New Zealand with a new
down with, you know, these a new two coaching two series. Yeah. By the way, they don't, yeah, it's not on
definitely with the new coaching staff. I can see 1-1 in New Zealand. I mean, do you remember in the, was it 2014 when England last went
Eden
down
Park.
There?
Nearly won at Eden Park.
At Eden Park with, I think Freddie Burns was playing. I think there was a real untested Marlon Yard running straight over Richie McCaw. You know, stranger things have happened than England going and sort of ruffling a few feathers in New Zealand, especially new coaching staff. Obviously, Scott Robertson, a proven coach of world-class repute, but he is embarking on a journey, and sometimes it takes a while for things to bed in, and England are seemingly riding the crest of a wave at the minute, and they could go down there and ruffle a few feathers, I don't doubt it.
And what's quite interesting about that is that traditionally England's best chance has been in that first game, because the home side have less kind of less cohesion, less momentum, I guess. England have that test against Japan before they play New Zealand in the in Dunedin, and it'll be New Zealand's first game under Scott Robertson. So that's the chance, you'd say. And then they go to Eden Park, where nobody ever wins. So
no. What's happening in that Japan game?
It's Steve Borthwick versus Eddie Jones.
It's Steve Borthwick versus Eddie Jones for the first time.
It's narratives week, Charles. That's what it is.
It is narratives week.
We're going to be writing a lot of comments. I was going to just quickly ask you about how Wales are getting in Australia, but I've just seen a story in the Aussie Daily Telegraph that apparently Leinster have made a move to try and sign Taniela Tupou to bring him over, which is kind of, I mean,
fabulous.
Australian rugby at the moment just seems to be the crown jewels, the emerging talents, the best players are just getting picked off either by league or by clubs overseas.
I think Leinster will be all right in the knockout stage of the Champions Cup with Taniela Tupou at tight head and Najee Snyman at lock. I'd probably be okay with
Doug Furlong coming off the bench.
Might be hard to beat.
We mentioned at the World Cup, and I'll say it again, because we saw a lot of Australia, that they have world class individuals. They couldn't string it together, and when some of those individuals were missing, they really didn't have the depth. They suffered more than anybody. But you still maintain that Australia's starting 15 could trouble anybody, and Taniela Tupou is one who encapsulates that theory better than anyone, embodies that theory better than anyone. I mean, he is sort of freakishly strong, and the quickest feat of maybe any prop in the history of rugby union, and he is quite injury prone, but what a signing that would be. I'd love to see him play in Europe. I'm a massive, massive fan. An incredible tight head prop, world 15 standard, and if Leinster were to capture him, I'd be sort of maybe looking at a season ticket.
Heading over to Dublin. I'm very
no, I'm not allowed.
I'm very intrigued to see what kind of tune Joe Schmidt can get out of the Wallabies in year one. Is Mark Namakani-Tawasi staying, or is he off to league? I mean,
no, he's going to league at the end of this season, I believe, but I don't know what that does with regard to the summer internationals.
I mean, stuff like that just makes you think. That's quite grim, isn't it? You want their best players available. Might be a chance for Wales to kind of get back on board. Like we said, Jack Morgan will be back. So, yeah, an interesting summer. Right, that's it, everybody. Thank you so much for being with us for all of the episodes through the Six Nations. We've really enjoyed doing it again and appreciated all your comments and all your questions and feedback for the last 8 weeks. It's your support is much appreciated, so thank you very much. Please keep up with everything that we're writing and doing on the website. We some of us might have a few days off over the next couple of weeks just to recharge, but we'll have plenty going on as we finish the domestic season and then build into the summer, and then you might hear from us again then. But until then, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.